This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark, brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.starktruthradio.com.
Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Ashley Messinger. Ashley, great having you back on the show.
Thanks for having me again.
Ashley, we're going to be discussing your recent articles. Would you say there's an overall theme to your last several articles?
Well, there are two articles that I've done fairly recently within the last few months covering... There's this fairly marginal discipline within philosophy called the philosophy of psychiatry, which is primarily concerned with how to go about defining the concept of mental illness. So I went into that and the social ramifications that some of that has in the earlier post of the two, which was called Diseases, Disorders, and Illnesses. Oh my, it's Brandon's title, of course, not mine. And then the later one... the most recent one, in fact, was also about mental health, and it discussed the emergence of various different kinds of psychological maladies recent in human history, and whether or not they make sense, their existence makes sense, or the prevalence of them in light of certain aspects of biology, and specifically of evolutionary theory, evolutionary reasoning, and... I went into several different factors that could contribute to it. I discussed the concept of trauma and the field of psychiatry itself, what it might be doing, social and cultural taboos that are unique to the modern West, and peripherally, though it's still important, genetic factors. So I think that's a decent summary. Unless you also want to talk about the other ones, like the Chavs Are Not Listening, or were you mostly interested in the psychiatric stuff?
Yeah, we can discuss all those themes. As far as diseases, disorders, and illnesses go, you discuss things like Asperger's syndrome and ADHD. So there's this whole discussion, like, what is it, a personality trait? Like, who gets to determine, like, what's a whether it's a pathology or not? Because there's this whole movement called neurodiversity, which basically puts forth the idea that it's a distinct personality trait rather than a pathology.
Right, and I would basically agree with that. In fairly recent times, certainly prior to the 20th century, there was a recognized concept, maybe not in these words, but it was certainly a thing, of just normal oddness. That is, we could accept... that some individuals would be deviant from average but didn't necessarily feel any need to medicalize them. In the case of something like Asperger's syndrome, it seems to be on the extreme right tail, so let's say the 90th percentile and up, of certain elements of normal personality, such as a tendency to be interested in systems, withdrawal from social interaction. Some people would just call it introversion. And there's no reason to think that these traits, in an evolutionary sense, aren't adaptive in some environment, and therefore no reason really, at least so far as I can see, to categorize them as a disorder. People with these traits are quite capable of being reproductively successful, formidably powerful in their reasoning ability and reaching the top of their field of interest, law, science, whatever it might be. There are lots of people with these traits in those disciplines. And for the most part, it seems to reflect a tendency on the part of certain bureaucrats, pen pushers, just generally kind of bad people, people in the school system and so on, who don't find these traits convenient to their sensibilities or the constraints attendant to doing their job. So another example would be ADHD. Again, the traits associated with that quote-unquote disorder are continuously distributed within the population. And so the decision about where to call it off and say from this point onward it's disordered, it's maladaptive, or whatever it might be, is ultimately just a matter of current fashions. And the way that this comes out really starkly is that you can see that in there's a disparity in the rate of diagnoses for ADHD and its subtypes, the attention deficit disorder without hyperactivity variety, all of them. You see that consistently younger children are more likely to be diagnosed than older children, which is a sign that they're just doing something that teachers find inconvenient because they're misdiagnosing immaturity, basically, or youth as a disorder, which I think is quite terrible.
Do you reject the concept of mental illness altogether?
No, not entirely. So I think that there should be two definitions, in my opinion, which is what I went into in the earlier post. So there's a Darwinian conception of mental illness, which is basically just anything, any embodied psychological phenomenon which is maladaptive, which is to say it annuls or reduces reproductive fitness or just has no fitness benefit across environments. So this would include things like schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, and all sorts of other very obvious examples come to mind. But there should also be an applied definition, which basically regulates what to medicalize. So the medical definition as it exists now is defined by the Diagnostic Manual of Mental Disorders and so on, and other organizations like the American Psychiatric Association. It's something to do always with impairment to daily functioning. What I would suggest is that we should combine something similar to that, which would be just the desire to change something about oneself, either on the part of the individual or people who have presumptive responsibility for that individual, such as family members, combined with the fact of it being a psychological attribute which is maladaptive across environments in a Darwinian sense, as I explained earlier. But I do also think that certain therapies, certain drugs, or whatever it might be, should be legal regardless of the minutiae of whether or not we count a certain way of being as a disorder. For instance, people who quote-unquote self-medicate with various types of things to deal with anxiety and so on, I don't see any reason why that should be socially taboo, whether or not they have a mental disorder, either diagnosed under the current system or under the system that I propose. Yeah.
So is it the issue that, as far as people who have these conditions, is it that society as it's currently structured fails to provide them a pathway to succeed?
Yes, I would say so. Even in the case of psychopathy, which is seen as an unalloyed good in the present culture, there are ways that people like that could be put to good use, certainly. Even in the medical profession, it's not hard to think of situations, say, a heart surgeon or a person who deals with emergency medical situations, an extreme profusion of empathy in the moment of treating these things is probably not a particularly good thing. So we need people who are unempathic, who are quite cold, who are able to just deal with people's maladies essentially as they would repair a computer or whatever it might be. And we also need people who are ruthless in business and so on. That's not a comment on capitalism or whatever, or the incentives that are created by that, which is something else you might be interested in. But certainly we need a wide variety of personalities, and it's safe to assume that the reason these personalities which are presumed to be dysfunctional in under present conditions, the reason they exist in the population in the first place is because they must be adaptive and then, one ventures to say, useful, at least in some situations, and I think we should be accommodating to that.
We discussed this on our previous show on education.
Right.
But there's this premise in society that everyone should be good at everything, so that includes, I mean, people should be good at social skills, they should be good at math, athletic, good English skills, but it would make more sense just to have a specialized based economy and educational system. So, and a lot of these kinds of personality traits, those are the kind of people who might have one area of expertise, but that would be a much more... But there, yeah, there's this premise that everyone needs to be good at everything. So, let's say someone has one talent, but they don't have like the proper social skills or social capital, then they're not going to succeed.
Yes, I would largely agree with that. And I think there was, at least at some point, one hesitates to talk about the past in this kind of romantic way, but you do see a trend towards specialization in modern economies, and as opposed to, and this is something that the economist Robin Hanson talks about, we have forager minds that are more generalist. We're inclined to be interested in many different kinds of things, but talents are obviously, they tend to be more specialized, and there's no need to try to cultivate abilities in people that they don't show any even rudimentary proficiency in, which is why many people find the rigmarole of the modern school system so depressing and enervating, because they're expected to jump through all these loops trying to become proficient in things that they have no natural aptitude for. Yeah.
So as far as the world of trauma goes, are you making the point that in Freud history there hasn't been a clear definition of trauma or any cases in history of someone having PTSD?
Well, the word itself originated in the 1690s, and back then this was well before the modern science of psychiatry was, well, science inverted commas. Certain parts of it are scientific, but we could argue about that. But well prior to any of that being discussed, there was early medicine focused on physical ailments. And in the 1690s, the term trauma referred only and specifically to physical injury, physical wounding, and the connotation of psychological wound didn't pick up until much later, as I went into. And there are many social phenomena, many things that are called trauma in the psychological sense, which, as I say, is more recent. Prior to the 20th century, there doesn't seem to be any record of them. And post-traumatic stress disorder does seem to be an intriguing example of this, in that if the standard narrative about it were true, we would expect there to be more record of it in history in the medieval period. The Romans would have talked about it, yet we don't see much of this, and Greg Cochran has made this point, who's an interesting... formerly a physicist, I believe, at one point, but he deals mostly in genetics and evolutionary theory now, and he's discussed this point that in the aftermath of World War II, if the standard narrative about PTSD were correct, we would expect countries such as Germany and Russia to have incidence rates of these kinds of syndromes hundreds of times greater than the United States, which doesn't seem to be the case. So it's either a consequence of psychiatrists egging people on, effectively encouraging these kinds of things, or at least enabling them, or it's because of some new factor that's entered the equation in the 20th century, or maybe just a bit earlier. Like, I think he suggests modern artillery and modern weapons, which have brought with them this capacity to cause physical damage to the brain that wasn't there when we were just fighting with swords or whatever. So yeah, it's some combination of those two things. And PTSD is just, it's a great quintessential example of one of these psychological traumas for which doesn't seem to make much sense in evolutionary terms, and it seems to be explicable in a way that isn't generally talked about in the standard cultural narrative or even within standard psychiatry. Yeah.
So, do you have an explanation into what is trauma, what causes trauma?
Well, the thing is, if you look at it in evolutionary terms, so I went into this in the post, there are basically two types of experiences that this term could encompass, and it's worth emphasizing we are talking specifically about the psychological form of trauma, as opposed to, you know, head trauma or leg trauma, being physically injured or something like that. So there's a form of trauma which is adaptive, which is to say that it would be evolutionarily selected for because it would increase or enhance people's inclusive fitness. It would allow people to leave more copies of their genes in the ecosystem, is just having an unpleasant memory, basically. It makes sense, and this is the example I gave in the post, to have an unpleasant memory of touching an electric fence because it means you won't do it again. But it doesn't make sense to have the memory of touching the electric fence or whatever your experience might be, psychologically torturing and tormenting you for years after the fact. And Greg Cochran mentioned this in his blog post, which I linked on PTSD. Our evolutionary history was filled with all kinds of horrendous unpleasantness, warfare, childbirth, and all these sorts of things. And the adaptive solution to all these things seems to be just to get over it, which means that the present situation with all these disorders, I mean, I'm not saying that it doesn't exist, but there's something about current conditions that must be exacerbating it or bringing forth tendencies that weren't there before. And it's also possible that media hype has a certain amount to do with it. For example, Jordan Peterson, the messianic Jordan Peterson of all people, brought this up in a recent conversation with Milo Yiannopoulos, in which they were discussing the latter's strange psychiatric history, let's say, and his quote-unquote abuse as a child or as a teenager. And Jordan Peterson made the point that even most children who are molested, that is to say prepubescent children who are raped or whatever, most of them recover with very little psychological damage, which is not to justify this, of course, which is what some people would say, and that's why the paper which mentioned these findings, he basically suggested that it had been memory hold, and indeed I can't find it anywhere, which makes sense. But most people molested as children don't experience much, if any, long-term psychological damage, for instance. So that's a good piece of evidence to suggest that the media, social media, the internet, and psychiatry, perhaps, is inflating the trauma caused by these things out of proportion to what it actually is. And like I said, that's not to justify them, even if the actual damage even only is short-term in most cases. The fact that running out in public and, say, punching somebody in the face or whatever might not cause someone lasting trauma, lasting damage, nobody says that that justifies that behavior. So I don't think that's a compelling moral argument, and anything should be fair game to talk about where this kind of thing is concerned.
So the mainstream response would be that people in the past were just ignorant about psychology and mental health.
Indeed.
That's the mainstream response? You're actually making the point that modern psychology and the media conditions people to have trauma. So you're not necessarily saying that they're just, that the victims or whatever are just, they're just adopting like a grievance culture or a victim culture, but actually that modern psychology and the media conditions people to have actual trauma.
Well, the grievance culture part, which is I suppose it's kind of a conservative talking point, isn't it? Which is why I suspect many people would have a negative reaction to it. But that probably is true in some cases. For instance, I linked a video by Lindsay Shepherd talking about the bizarre mental health culture in Canadian universities, where there's almost a kind of social status afforded to having mental disorders, especially depression, which is an interesting phenomenon. But I don't think that's the whole picture, no. I think it could be that psychiatry is a novel phenomenon. It's a biologically evolutionary novel phenomenon. We don't have adaptations that are meant to deal with it, with cultural narratives and taboos and behaviors that might actually be making these problems worse. Many studies of therapy, for instance, cognitive behavioral therapy, they turn up not particularly encouraging results, you could say. Many null results or weak effects. And I think there is a monetary incentive, unfortunately, for many of these positions to continue existing within psychiatry. There's a sort of, well, there's money to be made in depression, as sad as that sounds. And I think really what we should be doing is investing in true rewiring of our neurology to the extent that that actually is possible. The sorts
You're talking
of things
about transhumanism or technology that's available currently? So talking about rewiring the brain to eliminate depression or anxiety?
Well, for example, drugs. We should invest more money into drugs, I think, more targeted drugs with fewer side effects. Maybe AI could help with this. I don't want to be that person who says, oh, AI will fix it. But, you know, machine learning, these kinds of things could aid us in the quest to develop designer drugs, maybe tailored to people's individual neurologies to reduce side effects and create more lasting happiness, lasting positive outcomes. And also beyond that, you could view that as kind of a stopgap, to be honest, in lieu of genetic engineering, because ideally we should be able to just iron these kinds of genetic kinks out of the human genome so that we don't need to perpetually self-medicate to get rid of these problems. We'll just have a genetically pre-programmed health, which will be nice.
Do you think a lot of these psychological problems like anxiety and depression are caused by people whose their personality type isn't able to click with society, and they're not able to form healthy social bonds and become socially and economically prosperous?
Well, certainly there's a genetic component to it, but it's always a question of how the genetics interact with current circumstances. And yes, certainly social anxiety, there's an expectation that everybody needs to be social because we are primates. It is kind of a fundamental human motivation to want to form coalitions with other people and so on. But I don't see it as any sort of moral imperative. And I think introverts, people who gain their psychological energy and their happiness from being alone, I don't think that's any less moral or worthy than the standard way of being, which is, I guess, extroversion. And I do believe that's actually far more common than people who are truly introverted. So, yeah.
Is the whole culture of trauma, is it used to enforce moral and social taboos?
Yes, I would say so. So I gave an example of an ancient society that doesn't have taboos of ours regarding the same taboos we have about sex and age. So for instance, it's relatively universally agreed upon under current conditions that it's psychologically harmful for anybody earlier than a late adolescent, like say a 16, 17, 18-year-old to have sex. And anything before that is going to cause psychological damage. But if you imagine what this would be like in any species other than humans, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense, because we know that the onset of sexual desire and ideation and fantasy and so on is usually present in human beings by age 10, almost always by age 12 or 13, commensurate with changes in the reproductive system. And the reason that those desires exist in the first place is to facilitate reproduction. And so in other animals, it wouldn't make any sense for there to be this period where you have that desire which is to facilitate this activity, i.e. sex and reproduction, but then any acting upon or attempt to fulfill those desires is commensurate with tremendous lasting psychological damage. So I do think that's a cultural taboo, and it's one that isn't universal across human cultures, either in time or in space. So I gave the example of ancient Greece, where it was accepted and quite common for daughters to be married to older men at the age of, well, 14, for example. A lot of girls were married by 14. And the parents of those girls were, of course, concerned for their welfare, concerned with whether they could be provided for by their husbands, give their children a stable living, and so on. But they weren't worried about this long-term psychological anguish by having sex that many people seem to, that people talk about these days. And yeah, so that's basically that.
Well, you mentioned that incident with Milo Yiannopoulos, and there was this massive moral outrage about that. And I think what it was is because he sort of implied that he was not traumatized. So even though Milo said that he was the victim, the way he worded it caused this massive moral outrage, and he was made into this villain by both the morally, like the morally self-righteous left, and as well as a lot of the socially conservative right.
Yes, I would basically agree with that, and it is the case probably that under current conditions, I keep using that phrase a lot, it probably is the case under current conditions that people who do have sex at very young ages, like say 12 or 13 or whatever today, are likely, I think it's a correlation versus causation thing, they're likely to have psychological issues that people who wait for longer probably don't have. But I think that's a kind of selection effect which is similar to just the general, the correlation, the negative correlation between IQ and crime, for instance. So there's a sense in which high IQ people are more likely to follow prevailing social norms, whereas low IQ people who have higher rates of neuroses and mental disorders and so on are more likely to just ignore those. And I think it's a consequence of that phenomenon. It's not that having sex at those ages in and of itself is psychologically harmful, if you see what I'm saying.
So if people are convinced that if you break a social taboo, that's going to be trauma, that's such a powerful force in itself that people actually will experience psychological trauma.
Yes, that might well be the case. Possibly not in everybody, but like I said, there's no precedent for this in human history. There was none of this because people were more concerned with survival and just subsisting, existing. So this culture of enforcing trauma, you could say, didn't really exist. And I think some portion of people, and like I said, the media is blowing it out of proportion. Most people, when you actually look at the studies, are fine ultimately, etc., etc., which is a separate question from the moral considerations. But yes, some percentage of people are affected by it, and it causes them real genuine problems. That would be my thesis. Yep.
And when it comes to those issues, I think people with different psychological profiles or different personality types might react to it differently. Some people might have severe trauma, and then some people might just be fine. I think different people are wired differently to react differently to different experiences.
Yes, certainly. That makes sense.
You wrote about unrealistic adaptions have different genetic and psychological traits adapt to their surroundings, and then how they become more common over time.
Yes, well, that was specifically in the context of religion. I don't think it makes sense to view religion as a genetic adaptation, because for one thing, its characteristics are so disparate across cultures. There are some commonalities across religious systems, but they're rather few and far between, so it's unlikely that they could all be expressions of some unified evolutionary adaptation. And I was also indirectly calling into question certain narratives about the necessity of religious belief for civilization at the group level. So we know that from Peter Turkin's work, who does macro history, he takes this kind of scientific approach to history, and this has been studied. In fact, the evidence, tentative as it is at the moment, seems to suggest that religions, moralizing religions, big gods as he calls them, religions that place a huge premium on controlling people's moral behaviors, don't arise until after civilization has arisen. Large cities and so on of several million people, and it's not until after those things have arisen that you start to see these sorts of religious systems. So I would suggest that religion is mostly a consequence of various psychological byproducts, as opposed to being an adaptive feature of our biology in and of itself. It's obviously within priesthoods and so on, these kinds of high status institutions, it's a means of acquiring status and acquiring access to mates, the same as being a CEO is in modern culture, or whatever it might be.
So you're talking about cultural traits such as organized religion, or about biological traits that adapt through evolution?
Yes. And I was calling into question whether or not evolution could evolve as an adaptation, especially given the fact that in just the last couple of generations, it seems to have completely disappeared, which in certainly not across the board, but in the first world in European cultures, and that has all of the hallmarks of a complex socially learned behavior, which is contingent on certain incentives that don't exist anymore. It doesn't have the hallmarks of something that's been strongly evolutionarily or genetically selected for, like IQ, for example, which even despite pronounced dysgenic selection against IQ, it still hasn't declined all that much, and that's a sign of something that is strongly selected for when it's resistant to damage.
Because we were talking about personality traits, different societies may select for different personality traits from an evolutionary standpoint.
Yes, that's also true, and I'm interested in gene culture coevolution, so the way that, for instance, the systems of authority and cultural institutions in a society can make it more or less difficult for certain types of genes to proliferate, which will cause evolution. So a good example, or just something that pops to mind immediately in the present, would be something like the Saudi criminal justice system, or maybe the Singaporean justice system, who have extremely harsh punishments for various offenses, and that will eventually take those genes out of the genetic tumbler, and there should be a decline in those behaviors across time, similar to the phenomenon that occurred in Europe with the war on murder and so on.
Oh yeah, that's what Kurt Doolittle said this when he was on the show, that one of the reasons that Europe and Northeast Asia has less criminals is because they had this long history of mass executions, and that wasn't really the case in the Southern Hemisphere. and that could be a factor why Europeans and Northeast Asians are more law-abiding.
Yes, certainly in Europe. I know less about East Asian history at this moment, but in Europe I believe it was 1% of the male population basically in each generation was exterminated before they could reproduce. So yes, I think that's the evidence supports that thesis.
And you wrote about antinatalism, the article "The Chavs Are Not Listening." And, well, chavs are just like the white proletariat in Britain, but you talk about the demographic profile of antinatalist. They tend to be socially liberal, high IQ people of Northern European descent who are very much into esoteric thought. But the issue with antinatalism is... obviously, it's not going to become a mass movement. It's going to be a very select... esoteric niche, and basically they're just removing themselves from the gene pool.
Yes, and that's why I use the term chav in that particular post, basically as just a stand-in for low IQ people in general, and how low IQ people will systematically outbreed high IQ people, which is the stratum of society from which I would imagine, well, I don't need to imagine, it's definitely true, the stratum of society that the vast majority of self-identified antinatalists come from. High IQ people, and therefore the people most likely to affect change in the living world, to actually reduce suffering, are effectively cutting themselves out of the gene pool. And another problem with it is that because high IQ societies tend to be the most functional, the most happy for that reason, less daily drudgery, more freedom to spend on leisure and on your own pursuits and so on. So it's actually reducing suffering if it does only for the most privileged and comfortable people. So I would say that this philosophy is at best useless, is basically my diagnosis, if not worse.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it definitely have a dysgenic effect if antinatalism really caught on. It used to be a kind of fringe esoteric movement. There's two elements of it. There's the more philosophical antinatalist who believe that human life is inherently tragic, so that people should just not reproduce. But then in the mainstream left, there's an antinatalist movement primarily because of the environment and ecological issues. And you're seeing all these a lot of these op-eds in major newspapers telling people not to have kids because it's a major burden on the environment. But a lot of these same media outlets are the same ones would be very supportive of mass immigration, so there's not a level of consistency. But because of the issues we discussed, antinatalism is really counterproductive.
Yes, and like you say, it is a hilarious irony of Swipple culture. For instance, you get Joe, I live in an all-white gated community but want to open the borders, Rogan. Is an interesting individual, yeah. And others, of course.
And your other article, The Age of the Orangutans, it is about this kind of demographic trend of dysgenics and declining IQ. And your point you're making is that it's very difficult to reverse this through public policy, but you make the point that gene editing, cybernetics, transhumanism, could potentially address these concerns.
Yes, and I was lamenting the apathy in current Western populations to these issues and just the ignorance of them. And I think, I can't remember if I went into this in that post, but it's certainly germane to it, so I'll mention it anyway. I'm not sure if we can rely on voluntary eugenics entirely to fix some of these issues. I think pragmatically it may be too important for the clumsy hands of the vulgar masses to be allowed to control. We need some sort of mandatory program of increasing IQ, and I do think that's of supreme importance, as much as I do value increasing hedonic set points, making people happier and so on. That's also important. but if we don't have intelligence, we don't have civilization, we'll just degenerate to the level of, I mean, most people on this planet are basically close to chimpanzee levels of intelligence anyway, easily 95% of them. But we need these interventions to make sure that we all don't end up like that, and because of dysgenic selection, because there could be no coming back from that, and it'll be the end of civilization.
Yeah, because if you live in a society that is higher IQ, it just, as you said, there's more leisure, it's just an all-around higher quality of life. Even for the people, I mean, for people who have lower IQ, there's the issue of inequality, but even for those people, their quality of life would improve as well.
Yes, and it is an interesting dilemma working out how increasing intelligence will affect people's ability to have fun, which is obviously the most important thing in the long run. Funism, having fun, increasing the amount of fun in the universe. The AI researcher Eliezer Yudkowsky has a series of blog posts on his website, lesswrong.com, exploring what he calls fun theory, how to increase the amount of fun in the universe, and its implications for the modification of human intelligence. Because, for instance, if you make everybody hyper-intelligent, on the one hand, some would argue that it would make things boring, because it would make various problems that tax people's minds easier to solve, maybe trivially easy to solve. But it's also the case that having higher intelligence opens and broadens the possible space of fun, you might say, or the possible space of activities that people have access to, which chimpanzees don't have access to, for example, because they're just not as smart as us. So yeah, it's interesting to watch unfold, and one of the ways to get around this maybe would be with AI creating hyper-immersive computer simulations or exploring altered states of consciousness with the aid of general AI and these kinds of things. Yeah, it's interesting to watch unfold.
As far as eliminating mental illness and things like anxiety and depression through genetic engineering, have you heard the argument that it would also eliminate creativity, because a lot of creativity does come from psychological trauma? If someone's always happy and at ease, then there's going to be less innovation, especially not so much on the scientific angle, but as far as art and literature and music goes.
Well, I wonder if that's a common cultural perception. I would be interested to see an actual study done on that, on the relationship of creativity to neuroses. I don't think it's worth it from what I've seen. The paradox seems to be that people who are extremely unhappy all the time, melancholic depressives and so on, those are usually the least productive people, the most likely to suffer from learned helplessness and so on. But the trick is to not just induce a state of constant euphoric mania without information sensitivity. We need to retain information sensitivity, and one may so that people can retain critical discernment and judgment and so on. And one way to do this might be increasing hedonic set points. That is just the general baseline level of happiness that people are likely to experience at any given point of their lives, which is much higher for some people than others. And from what I've seen, very happy people, they do tend to be more productive generally than depressives.
Before we get to the end of the show, Ashley, is there anything else you'd like to add about any of these topics?
Nope, I think we've about covered it, so.
Ashley Messinger, it has been an excellent show. Thank you so much for being on.
Thank you very much for having me again, Robert. It's great.